This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the elders past and present and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonisation and genocide are ongoing processes that are still continuing to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the show where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a side of crispy memes. We're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, so go and join that group if you want to see some memes about Auspol. My name is Zach LeSnack. I'm a mod from the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, and with me, as always, is my co-host.
Hey, I'm Noon. On Facebook, I'm Uno Funkenstein. I'm the creator and admin of Auspol Shitposting, and I'm very glad to be back doing another episode with you, Zach.
Always a pleasure, Noon. Nice to see your face. Thank you for joining me once again. Thank you also to Daniel, who has upgraded his monthly donation to $10 on our Patreon. We appreciate that very much. There is a special snack pod pin in the mail on its way to you right now, if not already at your house. Sorry that we missed that last week.
Yep.
When you actually upgraded your thing. We'll do better in future. So this week we've got an interview for our mains coming up later in the show, which is very exciting. It's with Jack from the Rent Strikers and a new and exciting venture, which they'll go into detail in the interview. Mm-hmm. Noon, you had a little preview clip.
Yeah. Why didn't you go ahead?
You just
and play
wanted
that.
To play. I'll play that.
Bad call from the government is you go and have a curry for the.
Go and have a curry for the. Hey, I'm going to tell the Prime Minister that one. A curry for the country. I love it. I love Indian food. It's my favourite food. I promise you, I will do that.
All right. Well, that's obviously the wrong clip.
That's the wrong clip.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, sorry, I'm not sure how that got in there. Anyway, stay tuned for that interview later in the show. But before we get into our entree this week, Noon, you had a little something else that you wanted to get into.
Yeah, why don't we play that brand new sting?
Oh, I'm not going to make it.
Okay, cool. Well, why don't you just play that that sting for us, Zach?
You fucked up.
Yeah, so this week, the people who fucked up were me and Zach.
Hey!
All right. I think
first time winners. That's probably not true. But.
No, I'm sure we've issued mild corrections before. Luckily these ones aren't huge, but they are embarrassing. The big one, which a number of people wrote to us about, was about our story about Anastasia Palaszczuk last week getting the flu vaccine on camera, but it was done fake. And we and a bunch of other media breathlessly reported her doing this fake, vaccine. We did not put in the appropriate amount of research for that story. And apparently, literally moments before, she had got the actual one done. And the camera person was like, oh, that was too quick. Sorry, we didn't really get a good shot. Could you do it again? And so that's why they did it again with the cap on. So Anastasia, please forgive us. And listeners, please forgive us for peddling false information.
Bad.
There was one other much smaller thing, which thanks to George for writing in about this, that John Barilaro is the leader of the Nationals in New South Wales and the deputy premier, not the deputy leader of the Nationals. So anyway, thanks for correcting me on that.
That was my bad. That was on last week's story about the by-election in Eden Monaro.
Yep.
We're lucky that we have such eagle-eared listeners.
Absolutely.
Eagles famous, obviously, for their acute sense of hearing.
Yes.
Time now to get into our entree. I don't really have a joke here. I was going to say something about, hey, for entree, we're having farts in the shape of a person or something like that. So,
it's
listener... Obviously, that needs some workshopping.
But just imagine that we had workshopped it and that it was funny.
Yeah, maybe you can insert your own insult about the subject of this week's entree, Alan Jones, who is obviously an enormous sack of shit, or chaff bag
fart
of shit, if you will.
In human form.
Yeah, it's basically a collection of stinky racist farts in the form of a human being. So, Alan Jones announced his retirement from radio this week. He is obviously... pretty much Australia's foremost right-wing talk show host.
Yep.
Probably talk show host full stop. Though his audience has been dwindling for some time. So he's retiring from radio on health grounds, basically doctor's orders. His statement said that I'm taking the advice of the experts on this one, which prompted lots of sarcastic comments across social media from people being like, oh, is that the first time that you've ever done that?
Yeah.
But yeah, look, little overview of AJ, you know, because I've literally never listened to his show because
why would you?
I'm not a 75-year-old liberal voter.
I had a little bit to do with him because, well, not directly, but because of Lock the Gate. He was really on board with that and, you know, a classic broken clock situation that he was like, oh, these farmers fracking their land is terrible. We need to stop it and whatever. But yeah, I was always really uncomfortable about using his endorsement for the organization. But, you know, when you're trying to reach rural Nationals voters, he's a good name to have on your propaganda.
Yeah, take it where you can get it, I guess. But yeah, look, he started broadcasting in the mid-80s, and so this is obviously kind of like, it's a pretty different media and news landscape at the time. It's like pre-Fox News, and really before this kind of, he was like the tip of the spear, I guess, of this trend that we're seeing now of right-wing media basically completely replacing news with opinion over time.
Yep.
And he kind of prefigured that. He became kind of renowned, especially during John Howard's prime ministership, of basically getting conservative politicians onto his show so that they could bypass regular media outlets so they didn't get any kinds of hard questions and could just basically set the tone for whatever they wanted the media to be discussing that week, because he would just give them these basically softball interviews. Yeah.
It's interesting as well. As much as I hate to admit this, is sort of similar to the Lock the Gate thing of like a broken clock kind of thing. He is possibly the single person with the most power in the country, because what would happen every single day on air, people would call him with a problem and he would call up the prime minister or the, you know, liberal minister for whatever department and be like, hey, this guy needs you to sort this fucking shit out. And it would be done overnight, basically. So
John Howard had specific staff to deal
talk
with
to Alan Jones. Wow,
Alan Jones. Yeah. Yeah. So look, you know, obviously it's been a long and disgusting career full of racism, misogyny, and all sorts of other conservative nonsense. He's also just like a deeply corrupt individual. In 1999, there was the Cash for Comet scandal, where it came out that he was promoting sponsors of his show without disclosing that they had a sponsorship relationship with him. 2007 was he was found that he had encouraged the violence of the Cronulla riots and vilified Lebanese and Middle Eastern people. So that's another very you know, that's another trophy on the shelf for Alan.
Yep.
You know, he's basically, he's probably best known for his violent misogyny on the air, talking about how Julia Gillard should be drowned in a chaff bag.
Yep.
And most recently, his comment about Jacinda Ardern needing to have a sock shoved down her throat.
It's just horrible.
And it really fucking gross. But actually, it's interesting that, I mean, there's been a significant popular boycotts of his shows, and he's been losing advertisers for a while now. And in fact, after the Jacinda Ardern comment, he lost about half of his advertisers.
Holy crap.
So that's partially,
it's amazing that
work,
like, an overseas politician has more like pull for people boycotting than like Julia Gillard did, for example.
Yeah, people really, really like Jacinda Ardern, and I'm, you know, not going to get into it one way or the other, but, you know, she's likable, I guess. People feel defensive of her. But yeah, I mean, that's partially down to the work of organizations like Sleeping Giants and Mad Fucking Witches, who have been putting in a whole bunch of time and effort to organizing those advertiser boycotts. And so, of course, Jones is like, oh yeah, you know, it's because I am unhealthy, not because my audience is shrinking because they're dying, and because people aren't listening to the radio anymore, and because all my advertisers have left. It's, you know, it's health stuff. Of course, he's not going to disappear from, you know,
the public eye. Yeah.
Yeah, he's still going to write columns and do TV appearances on Sky and that kind of thing. So he's not gone yet. But look, of course, no, sorry.
I was going to say, I've got one more little story about Alan Jones, which was that my dad used to be a researcher in, like, child psychology, and had written a paper, I'm pretty sure it was about suicide contagion. So like when one person kills himself, then other people tend to, and so on. And at about 4:30 in the morning, the phone rang. This must have been mid-90s or something, like 4 in the morning. And Mum answered it and woke up Dad and was like, "Oh, it's Alan Jones. He wants to interview you about your article." And Dad was like, "Alan Jones? That dickhead? Tell him no." And like rolled over and went back to sleep. So, shout out, Dad. That was a good call. Yeah.
Go Norm. Nice one. Well, there were lots of sentiments in the media this week to the effect of the opposite of your dad's opinion from a bunch of right-wing commentators. So probably I might play that sting now.
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey.
A lot of competition for the top spot this week. Got a couple of tweets here I'm going to read. One is from Adam Creighton, who is, or maybe it's Crichton. I don't know. He is the financial editor of The Australian. I am 95% sure. And he's kind of fast becoming one of the like most ridiculed people on Australian political Twitter, and deservedly so. Until recently, he was wearing a bow tie in his profile picture, and then I tweeted at him, "Sick bow tie, dude." And now he's got a different profile picture where he's not wearing a bow tie.
Hey.
And I don't know if I can take credit for that, but I'm gonna.
I think that's a win for Snack Bud.
Alan Jones style. It was me. So Adam Crichton wrote, "Whatever you think of Jones's views, his work ethic, memory, and command of English were without peer. Perhaps the best radio broadcaster ever. Good to see him retire on top." I love it. Even though he's literally calling him the greatest radio broadcaster of all time, he's still struggling to find three things to say about him.
Yeah.
Two of them are memory and command of English. Like, bro.
Yeah.
Seriously, I'd be extremely offended if those are the top three things that someone had to say about me. My memory? Jesus. Anyway, that was a good one. There was another one from Mark Latham, who is obviously an absolute blurst take machine. He said, "Like Bradman and Menzies, Alan Jones is going out on top. No one in Australia's history has provided so much well-researched, edifying information to the public. A wonderful service to his nation. Congratulations and best wishes for the future, Alan." This guy, he's... Look, he's not going out on top. He's going out because his career is going down the toilet. And he's...
getting out while the going isn't quite as bad as it will be.
Exactly. But while those takes are pretty bad, the blurst one has to have been from Media Watch, who said there's been... On Twitter, the official Media Watch account said, "There's been many stoushes, but Jones's commitment to his listeners, his tireless work ethic, and rating success is to be congratulated."
I mean, is it really to be congratulated?
Blisteringly bad take, especially considering that Media Watch won a fucking Logie for exposing the Cash for Comment scandal back in 1999. So, interesting choice to do that. They then tried to kind of like put out the immediate Twitter fire because they got ratioed like extremely hard. They tried to put out the fire by like tweeting a whole bunch of like scandals of the involving Alan Jones that they'd reported on over the years. We're like, no, we
still
think he's a dickhead, we swear.
Yeah.
What's that Wint tweet? Got to issue a correction on my previous statement.
You do not on
ISIS. Yes. You do not under any circumstances have to give it to them. Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted that.
Yeah, so anyway. No, it's all good. All right, now it's time for our cheesiest sting. Hey, man, I've got some more beers.
Oh, I don't know if I can drink anymore. I'm feeling kind of sick.
No, come on, we're having another round of Coronas.
Okay, so this is just a quick one about Coronas. There's two kind of main stories that I wanted to mention. One is that the Australian government has spent $19 million on useless tests. These are ones that detect antibodies in the blood, I'm pretty sure. And they basically produce a huge amount of false positives. So they're almost completely useless because you can't tell if the result is actually accurate or not. And these haven't been rolled out, really, so it's unlikely that anyone has been tested with them. Or, like, people listening, if you've been tested, your results are probably accurate because these ones haven't been, like, gone out to the public. But, yeah, I think that is a funny and disappointing thing for the Australian government to have done.
Classic. Australian government.
The other thing is about sentinel testing, which is something we mentioned a couple weeks ago, which is like the sort of proactive testing that the government is doing. They're trying to reach sort of populations that they haven't tested for other reasons. And so this one thing is that they've been testing teachers before teachers go back to school. And there's been a bunch of asymptomatic testing. So for people who don't have symptoms, and I think mostly these are happening at Bunnings, but they're at other places too. So that's good to know. And like, that's going to give us more of an idea about how the population is like going corona-wise and if there have been undetected cases or undetected outbreaks. So yeah, that's good news. And I heard someone on the radio, that's just a little tip for listeners. If you have symptoms and want to get tested, you can go to one of the asymptomatic places and just not mention your symptoms. Someone on the radio who is like a tester came on and was like, yeah, we've had lots of people come who said they were asymptomatic, and then we tested them, and they're like, haha, I blew my nose like twice today. So, and she was inviting people to come and just like not mention it. So yeah, if you're worried you have corona and can't find somewhere that's testing symptoms, go to an asymptomatic place. Try not to cough on anyone.
Smart. Well, speaking of corona,
Shitpost of the week.
We got a corona-related shitpost of the week this week. This one goes out to James Halesis, first-time winner of Shitpost of the Week. Congratulations, Jimmy. So as we discussed about last week, the coronavirus restrictions, lockdown restrictions are being lifted very slowly, but currently in stage one pretty much across the country, which means that you can have 5 guests over to your home, mm-hmm. amongst other exciting things. And yeah, we've got a great Dimitri Discovers meme. I don't know if people know.
Is that the title of that meme? Yeah.
I think that's what it's known as, right. But it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know if anybody really calls it that.
No.
It's probably, that's, it's just more like
know
a
your meme
know,
entry
know
title.
Your meme.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But every meme template needs a name. But anyway, it's that the interview in a club with a Russian guy and they have a bit of a conversation, and then partway through he just starts gleefully dancing. And it is definitely high in the running for my favorite meme template of all time.
Wow.
My favorite one is definitely the one where he discovers that God is dead and we have killed him, and then he starts dancing. Dimitri is having a conversation with a reporter saying that he misses his friends. It's not quite the same having dance parties on Zoom and just dancing in front of a screen. And she lets him know, from this weekend, you can have 5 people over from a boog. And then he starts doing his own little boog of joy.
Yes. It's amazing even when you know what the meme is, it's still like the look of like innocent delight in his eyes is just so like pure and lovely, even though it's also clearly like chemically
the dance
induced.
Moves are all time.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah. Just sort of pushing his hands towards the screen, the occasional errant clap from time to time. Israel, look, Dimitri really does it for me. Mm. What can I say? Thank you, James, for this amazing content. If you want to see more memes such as that one, go over to the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook group, answer the questions, or we won't let you in. Probably now time to move on to our First Nations story, which also this week is going to double as our Positivity Corner.
Woohoo!
Positivity Corner.
Which is nice.
It is.
Isn't that nice?
It is.
This is a really, really nice story. This was reported on in The Guardian. So this is about Bruce Pascoe, the author of Dark Emu. He's a Koori author. Dark Emu, I'm sure most of our listeners will be familiar with it, but basically it's an account of the fact that Indigenous people on this country were not just hunter-gatherer, but in fact had a number of sophisticated methods of agriculture and farming. And as part of his work around this, Bruce Pascoe has started a farm in Victoria, near Mallacoota, near the New South Wales Victoria border, basically, where he's starting to try and plant and harvest a number of Australia's native plants. And he's just collected his first harvest of a plant called Mandadia Naluk, which is a Yuin word meaning dancing grass. So Pascoe and his team reckon it's the first time in 200 years that this grass has been harvested
wow.
for food. And Pascoe said of his team that is helping him harvest the grass, and some of these people are descended from those who would have done the last harvest. That's what this farm is all about, trying to make sure that Aboriginal people are part of the resurgence in these grains, rather than being on the periphery and being dispossessed again.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, if you read Dark Emu, like, he goes into a great amount of detail about how there were all these native plants that could very easily be harvested at scale and go and be used for commercial production. So he's very interested in trying to show people that it's realistic that we actually that we don't have to use imported crops in this country. And of course, it's far better for the land that the plants that were that evolved to grow in it, you know, as opposed to foreign crops, which can often be really destructive. So his property's in, as I've mentioned, it's in Mallacoota, which is an area that people might remember was really badly hit by the bushfires. So some of his property was also razed, but they've kind of rebuilt the sheds. They're filled up with grain. And people might remember as well, around that time that the bushfires were hitting was also the time that Bruce Pascoe was coming under attack from specifically Andrew Bolt. And Pascoe describes it as the worst time of his life.
Damn.
But one of the upshots of that whole saga was that sales of Dark Emu went way up.
Oh, that's apparently. Great. That's very funny.
And he's used, the money from those sales to hire the people who have come to harvest the grain on his farm, which is, so yeah, I mean, the way he sees it, basically a bunch of good has come out of it. I'll link this Guardian piece in the show notes because you should go and check it out because there's photos of a loaf of bread that they've made with the milled seed and it just looks so fucking delicious. And Pascoe talks about how he's, you know, received hundreds of emails from people who are super interested in getting this native flower when it becomes available. And I mean, I just think it's a really exciting development. I think that reconfiguring our food system is a massive piece of the puzzle when it comes to combating climate change. But obviously, it has to be done in such a way that doesn't ride roughshod over the rights of indigenous people. And I think that there's, you know, amazing opportunities for those two things to work in synergy. And this is a great example of the fact that it is possible. It's not some kind of pipe dream. So I just thought that was really cool for so many reasons. And the Guardian piece on it is gorgeous as well. It's like a photo essay. It's got a number of really lovely snaps of the process. So definitely recommend that you go and check that out.
Listeners, I am a big fan of another podcast called Ologies, where a woman named Ellie Ward interviews a different scientist or different ologist each week. And just recently she did an episode on gastro-Egyptology, which is about the history of food in Egypt, in like ancient Egypt, basically. And the guy she got on...
Beer time.
Yeah, totally, yeah. The guy that she got on is just this like super extreme type A nerd who tried to do like sourdough baking as a way to switch off from his job as like a software engineer / CIA employee. And instead he became the world's leading researcher in gastro-Egyptology.
When you accidentally do your hobby so hard that you become the
you like found a new
expert.
Field of science, yeah.
Did I do that?
One of the things that they did is like collect ancient yeasts from inside bits of broken pottery, and so they've isolated these like 5,000-year-old strains of yeast, and he's been using them to make bread, and he's tried using it on just like normal plain flour, and it doesn't really work very well, like not very well. And so he went and like found some like emma or something, some ancient Egyptian grain, and the yeast is just like, oh fuck yeah, let's have some of that. but anyway, I that's just sort of an exciting angle on bread making that I've been keen on at the moment. And this story about the dancing grass is a beautiful kind of tie in there. And I wonder what kind of exciting yeasts and microbes and like cooking techniques might be able to be rediscovered or like introduced along with those new ingredients, as well as like the practices and so on. So that's super cool.
There's so many exciting possibilities there, and Pascoe himself talks about, he's like, we just, you know, we let this land go and do what it needed to do, and then we found this new kind of little onion thing. We didn't really know what it is, but it was delicious.
That's awesome.
it's honestly, it's very exciting. Yeah. So, I'm hoping that we hear much more about that in future. All right, time to move on now to...
get some of that emotional whiplash that the show is so famous for.
Oh, yeah. That's what we like. Fashy Australia. I mean, this segment is called Fasci Australia, but it may as well be called, like, Dutton Watch,
yes.
I guess. Because really, it's just about... It's,
that's funny, you, but it's also very sad.
Yeah, I mean, he is a busy man, and he's busy trying to turn Australia into a fucking fascist police state, and he's had a busy week when it comes to doing that. So, he did two big things this week. Or, you know, he and his department. So the first thing is a bill was introduced to Parliament called the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation Amendment Bill 2020. Sounds, you know, chill.
Inoffensive.
Right? Sounds inoffensive. This bill has a bunch of pretty fucked shit in it,
yeah.
Would you believe? So if passed, it would allow ASIO to seek a warrant so they can question people between 14 and 18 if they're target of an ASIO investigation into politically motivated violence, which is obviously a pretty vague criterion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they can basically... They can get warrants to question kids now, which is obviously very cool and something that we should definitely be having our security agencies doing. Yep. It also gives ASIO a bunch of power to fuck with people's rights when it comes to having a lawyer with them when they're being questioned, so they can stop people choosing their own lawyer.
Well,
if they claim, and they only need to claim this based on hearsay, that the lawyer is a security risk.
Fuck.
And then they can be like, nope, you can't have the lawyer that you choose. They can also tell lawyers to leave the room when they're questioning people.
Jeez.
At their discretion, and they can now basically appoint people lawyers of their own choice. Technically, it's through a quote, independent prescribed authority. Mm-hmm. But obviously, that's an authority that's going to give ASIO very friendly lawyers.
Yep.
Yes.
There's another thing in this bill as well, which is changes to surveillance laws. So previously, things that might have needed warrants, so like putting tracking devices, you know, bugs or listening devices or GPS trackers on people's cars or in their handbag or whatever, previously needed a warrant signed by a judge, and now will more or less be able to be done with just an internal, like, decision-making process.
Yeah, basically, and they just need to, if an ASIO officer wants to, like, track an individual, now they just need to get the okay from another ASIO officer, orally.
Yeah, orally.
They have to do.
They don't even have to have it written down. Shit, I missed that bit. That's awful.
They have to do paperwork 2 days later at most, but they can just, yeah. Hey, does this seem chill to you? Yeah, seems chill. Go for it. Cool, that's legal. Yeah, nice. And yeah, I mean, the other element of that is like the technologies that they're allowed to use to describe in the bill as any technology ASIO has access to. So, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Big, broad, sweeping powers we're talking here. So the other bill that was introduced by the Home Affairs Department this week is the Telecommunications Legislation Amendment International Production Orders Bill 2020. Another catchy title.
Definitely designed to get people to read it, right?
Yeah, big time. How could anybody resist? So this is basically an attempt by the government to give itself the ability to sidestep protections on journalists' data. So when the Abbott government introduced mass surveillance laws in 2015, the media kind of realized, apparently, you know, a little bit belatedly, like, oh shit, this could be really bad for journalists if they can just access our data and they can find out who our sources are. So some last minute kind of protections were written in, and so now agencies basically need to get a special warrant if they want to get data relating to journalists or their sources, called a journalist information warrant, I'm pretty sure, from memory. But this new bill is proposing that Australia will be able to make agreements with, quote, like-minded countries, which obviously just means America, to get direct access to surveillance information from each other's agencies. So, you know, we'll be swapping data, including, like, real-time wiretapping and that kind of thing, basically instantaneously. And this new process, and it's in the name of the title, so the International Production Orders, that's what these things are called, IPOs. This new IPO process doesn't have any protections for journalists' data written in. So if that journalist's data is held by a US company, say Google or Facebook, they don't need to get a special warrant to access that data, which means, obviously, that journalists and their sources are going to be even more exposed than they currently are. We know this government has been on a rampage when it comes to press freedom, doing everything they can to undermine freedom of the press,
yeah,
and to scare anybody who is even thinking about speaking out against the government or security agencies into silence. So pretty fucked and very sneaky as well, that it's like, oh no, we're just doing this thing about sharing information with other spy agencies from across the world, and then they've just sort of left themselves this little back door so that they can secretly access Australian journalists' data as well.
Yeah,
it's very underhanded shit.
It's also like ties into what we've talked about a few times about the Australian Signals Directorate and like where the lines between spying on foreigners and spying on Australian citizens is, and like the way that media is supposed to be somewhat exempt from that. And yeah, there's just another way of them like carefully avoiding the separation between those powers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, this is absolutely like of a piece with their longer term strategy. And we should all be very concerned about it.
Yeah, not you and me, obviously, though, because we're not journalists, so we should be
fine.
We're
not journalists. Yeah. Yeah. We're a couple of quote-unquote chuckleheads.
Mm.
Cool, that probably wraps up our like news segments for this week. Now we're going to hear an interview with Jack... is it Jack B. Quick?
Yeah, Jack B. Quick, who is an Ausbol Shitposting member, has been for a long time... and who, yeah, has been involved in this rent and mortgage strike organizing, and now they're part of this new organization that's being set up, the Rental and Housing Union Victoria, I'm pretty sure it's called. And yeah, so I had a chat with them earlier this week. It was really good, and there's a bunch of cool stuff going on. And yeah, where we talk about solidarity of renters and share housing and... a bunch of other stuff. So yeah, I thought it was I learned a lot from it, from talking to Jack, and I hope you enjoy it too, listeners. Hi everyone, and welcome to a special Auspol Snackpod interview with Jack, who is a member of Auspol Shitposting on Facebook. They're Jack Be Quick, and they're here to talk to us today about the rent strike and a cool new organization that they're involved with. So Jack, could you just introduce yourself and tell us about the new renters union you're going to set up?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm Jack, longtime Auspol Shitposting lurker. Deeply infrequent poster.
It's true, you've been there for years.
Yeah, has it been years? Good stuff,
I reckon.
Yeah, and I am a recently unemployed person in the coronavirus crisis, and mm-hmm. I have been dealing with the turbulence of that by trying to fix large-scale problems so I don't have to think about my own problems. So I've been doing some organizing with the rent and mortgage strike group, which hopefully some people will have noticed floating around the internet a little bit. And we are about to kind of pivot the organization and some of the contacts and the very beginnings of some infrastructure that we've kind of developed from the strike action into a new renters and housing union for Victoria.
That's awesome. And just like, can you give us a few little details about the organization as it now? Like, how many people? What are you guys doing? You like having meetings? Just very briefly. I don't know. Yeah. Give us a little bit about what your current day to day is with the rent and mortgage strike people.
Yeah, totally. Well, of course, it's a left wing organization. Therefore, mm-hmm. meetings are compulsory and like constant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No, that's not true. Yes, we've been having meetings. Basically we had around 20,000 people sign the pledge that we put up online.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I signed that, but that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had nationwide, around 20,000 people signed the pledge to withhold their rent and mortgage payments. I know mm-hmm. that not all of those people actually have withheld payments, but
yep.
we have pledges of support from over 20,000 people, which is a massive deal, I think, that many people...
That's incredible.
Yeah, think that, you know, that the system that we're currently operating under is not dealing well with this crisis. It's just exposing kind of flaws that are inherent in it. Our initial plan was basically... It was a like really quick kind of reaction to the encroaching kind of coronavirus crisis, knowing that a lot of people were going to be out of work, out of money, mm-hmm. And knowing that people being told to self-isolate, being told to, you know, practice like physical distancing and everything, but wanting to make sure that people have like safe, secure accommodation that they can afford.
Totally.
To maintain that, like housing is a healthcare issue as well as a just a human right in general. Mm. And so through that, we've pivoted to the. Oh, sorry, you can go ahead.
No, no, go on. It's fine.
Oh, I was going to say, through the action of the strike that we've taken, we have had such an overwhelming kind of deluge of interest and requests for advice and assistance that we are going to be setting up this new renters and housing union.
That's fabulous. And we are going to talk about the rent strike. That's the main thing this interview is about. But first, I just kind of wanted to ask maybe a little bit about, you sort of alluded to it already about the coronavirus sort of showing all of these cracks in the system and so on. But could you just tell us a little bit about like how the coronavirus has affected renters and tenants and some of the impacts that that's had?
Absolutely. So we know that the majority of people who rent houses, like they rent the accommodation that they live in, are young people under 30. And those people are also more likely to be in precarious employment or within that kind of gig economy, working sort of like hand to mouth, people that have less savings and less kind of, less capital and security generally. So it's kind of hit that group of people. Also, it's a lot of people who work in industries that have been really hard hit as well, like entertainment, hospitality,
all
that kind of thing. So it's really like a perfect storm of like economic sort of just general malaise for people that are younger, people who rent accommodation, people who are lower incomes. And then there's also a lot of issues with who can claim the government payments that have been added or increased during this time as well. It's really not good. People may have noticed.
Totally.
Coronavirus, not fun.
It's a hot take, Jack, but, you know, I'll stand it.
Thank you. I know, I felt a little bit nervous putting that out into the world, knowing just how many people would really disagree with me. Coronavirus, I don't like it. And I'll stand by that.
Something that I kind of noticed when I was doing a bit of reading about this was the way that basically all levels of government have tried to respond to housing in coronavirus with trickle-down policies. They give, like, mortgage relief to the banks who will pass that on in mortgage repayments or whatever. And the hope is that, like, somehow the landlords or the owners or whatever are going to, like, show compassion for some reason that they've never done before, but they will this time for all of their tenants.
Yeah, you know, those paragons of charity and goodwill, 100%. The landlords and bosses of the world.
Yep. But you linked me to someone called Joshua Badge, who's a Melbourne philosopher who wrote a couple of articles about this, and there was just a couple of lines that I wanted to read from that. Sit down, talk to each other, and work things out, Morrison said, as if tenants and landlords are on equal terms, as if the coronavirus pandemic hasn't rendered the cruelty of the rental system in ultra-high definition. I really like that. And then another line, which was about the ban on evictions, which is kind of another part of the policy that we've seen throughout the nation in various different ways, but that it's kind of giving with one hand and taking with the other. And so this is Joshua Badge says, banning evictions is a step in the right direction. Still, it's only half a strategy. If you can't pay rent this month, you won't be able to afford arrears next month. Without further support, moratoriums create a debt trap, which will drag down thousands during an economic downturn.
Yeah. I mean, nail on the head right there. The I think actually one of the best memes that I've seen, if I may, if I may
please
bring memes into this.
Please. This is the perfect forum for it.
Right? So one of the best memes that I think I've seen about this was kind of going around a little bit earlier on in the coronavirus crisis, and it was just like the picture, the sort of high definition, like electron microscope picture of the virus saying like, nice system you've got there. Wouldn't you hate it if I just exposed the cruelty that's inherent to every level of it? And it totally is. It's, as you mentioned, like with the trickle down kind of approach as well, it's working the same with JobKeeper as well, you know, which as any of the people who are currently taking industrial action against their employers for holding on to their JobKeeper instead of paying them out the full amount as they were supposed to do might know, trickle-down economics doesn't fucking work. As anyone who's, like, trying to get their JobKeeper and can't, or anyone that sort of, like, has paid attention to the last, like, 40 or so years at the very least of global politics and economics, like, trickle-down economics, people, they don't, like, the people at the top, they don't actually really like to let things trickle down.
Literally 5 minutes before, sorry, this is a bit of a tangent, but it's funny, literally 5 minutes before we started recording this, I was listening to ABC Melbourne Radio, and this woman called in about an employee of hers who's a relative of hers who's getting JobKeeper, and she's like, I'm mad that she's getting all this extra money, but she's not doing any extra work. But it's like, and she wants to fire her relative, but it was money that she's, like, not paying out of her own pocket. Anyway,
damn,
sorry,
that
total
is
tangent.
Cold.
But yeah, you're right. It is cold
that is
as fuck.
Ice and cold. Like, not even nepotism can save that person.
Jeez. God. It's brutal. Okay, so back to rent strike. Can you tell us what is a rent strike?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's basically a form of collective action that operates on similar principles to a labor strike, which is when people working in the same industry or for the same company agree to withhold their labor in order to get their demands met. But this time it's withholding our rental payments in order to have our demands met. And there's a couple of extra kind of steps in that because it's not necessarily just the landlords that are the decision makers around that, because there are...
Totally.
I think it's this angle has definitely been wildly overplayed in a lot of media, but there are there do exist some people who are like, you know, your quote-unquote mum and dad investors who own like one rental apartment or something. And that's like
Our landlord
equity. But
he like literally built this house and still comes and like fixes our toilet. And I'm like, you know, I feel some empathy towards you, like a human relationship. But then obviously it's like a systemic issue that the rent strike's trying to deal with, not necessarily an individual one, though that too.
Yeah, and that's why we initially were talking about a rent and mortgage strike, because I mean, there are plenty of people who don't own investment properties that are paying a mortgage on the house that they live in, who are equally unable to afford their mortgage payments as other people are unable to afford rent. And then there's the smaller scale landlords who are, you know, not making gigantic profits from their one, two investment properties and things. But then there's also gigantic corporations that own terrifying amounts of housing, whole buildings of apartments, et cetera, et cetera. But those people are much better placed to stop paying rent, as we've seen by like some companies just saying like, actually, no, we're not gonna pay rent during this time. And so
right, there's been like commercial leases that they're not paying, right? Like
there was one that really intense retail places,
Myers or something like that. It was a really big department store that was
the company that owns like Just Jeans and JJ's and Portman's and heaps of retail things. So half of your average shopping center really said, actually, no, we're not going to be paying rent. But the difference between them and your average person just leasing an apartment or a house or something is that they can kind of get away with it a lot easier than just your average tenant.
Absolutely.
Which is where the collective action part of the rent and mortgage strike comes in. The principle is basically they can't evict us all. So if enough people kind of decide to not pay their rent, to withhold their rent payments, that puts pressure on landlords and real estate agents to then use their relatively much larger amount of power to pressure government do something on a wider systemic scale, such as the moratorium on evictions, which is a step in the right direction, but it's like one step in a journey of the right direction. Because like that quote that you read out absolutely nailed. So for example, like I'm unemployed right now and I fall through the cracks of JobKeeper and I'm waiting to see if I get JobSeeker, but it's not looking super likely right now. So there are lots of people like, if I can't pay rent now, then where am I going to get 6 months rent in September from after like 100%. What, 6 months of not working or like 4 months of not
and
working?
The
and
government's
2 months
now
of
also,
looking?
The government's now also talking about potentially winding JobKeeper back. I'm pretty sure it's JobKeeper.
Yeah.
Because they're not getting the like return on investment in terms of like keeping the economy afloat that they were hoping for.
Yeah. But like, even though they actually spent much less on that, they saved like a million claimants worth of money on that. They introduced it saying this will cover 6 million people. Only 5 million people are actually covered and claiming it. And they're still like, we're spending too much money. Oh, no.
It's also ridiculous because, like, for everyone's point of view except the government's, the point of these payments was to, like, support people to survive through a global pandemic and economic depression rather than to keep the, like, stonks number going up.
Which is not
like,
going to
like,
oh,
anyway. No, our stonks number. Right, exactly. Like, if everyone is unemployed and in precarious housing and not able to afford groceries, like, how the fuck are people going to, like, have valuable investment portfolios? But, yeah. So you kind of alluded to this a little bit, but, like, what are the goals that, or the asks that you have with the rent strike? Like, what's it going to achieve, assuming it all, like, you know, goes 100% perfectly or whatever? What's the dream scenario for your outcome?
Yeah, so the dream scenario was basically a moratorium on evictions, a suspension, an amnesty rather than a deferral all rent and mortgage payments for the duration of the coronavirus pandemic. So a lot of people use the 6 months kind of milestone, but we were saying for the duration of the pandemic. So basically until it stops, until there's no...
Spanish flu was like 1 to 4 years. So let's see.
Yeah. Like we'll give it a go. the full amnesty on rental and mortgage payments, a ban on evictions, a ban on blacklisting or otherwise generating kind of adverse consequences for people not paying their rent on time so that you can't sort of... So that people couldn't like... go on rent strike, even if the demands were achieved at the end of the moratorium period, they'd just be kicked out and be unable to get on another lease. Also a stoppage on any fees or penalties, interest, like debt accrued during the time as well.
Yep.
So can't say, oh yeah, I'll let you not pay rent for the next 6 months, but... even if you don't have to pay it all back at the end, you're going to have to pay like 20% more afterwards automatically.
Your missed rental amnesty fee or whatever.
Yeah,
or
processing like, fee.
Yeah. Cool. That's really good. And I think something that strikes me as super cool about the rent strike, I don't know if listeners can hear Bagel, my dog is having a big drink in the background. So
hi, Bagel.
You enjoy that texture, audio texture. Something that I think is really cool about the rent strike and probably part of the reason that 20,000 people were so like keen to sign on is that the outcomes and the action are so obviously and closely linked. And there's something that often bugs me in activist circles, which, you know, it's easy to criticize and I don't do as much activism as I'd like. So, you know, take this gently, but there's a lot of people like, especially creative performance activism or whatever, that I feel like the message gets lost significantly in the performance or whatever. And the goals and the actions don't really like line up that clearly. And anyway, I just think it's cool that the rent strike does connect. Like that not only are the people helping themselves with the action of not paying rent, but also collectively changing the world so as that becomes like normal and accepted and supported.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the reasons that has struck a chord with a lot of people. And I think also it's really cool to see the response be so positive from people who wouldn't usually support something that's considered quite a, I guess, radical, air
radical,
quotes, measure.
Yeah. Sure.
Because I think that there's been a real like long-term kind of chipping away within Australia and also internationally as well, but specifically in the context of where we are in Australia, over decades there's been this chipping away at ideas of solidarity and collective action and sort of the union type ethos of, like, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. There's a lot more of this kind of idea of, like, fuck you, I've got mine, that's, yeah, to be, you know, really eloquent about it, but that's kind of emerged, and a lot of people don't have that. They don't automatically understand the principles of standing in solidarity with one another. And so, yeah, that is something that I think the response that we've had to the rent and mortgage strike has shown is still there. Like, people do still have the impulse, even if it only kind of has come out under quite extreme duress, it is still there. And also that's something that we're kind of hoping to build back up with the renters and housing union over a longer term kind of thing. The idea of standing in solidarity with one another and recognizing that we have a lot more in common with one another, as, like, you're just average kind of person on the street, has a lot more in common with one another than they do with any billionaires or, you know, tycoons,
yeah,
et cetera, that is presented as so aspirational.
Yeah. Something that Joshua Badge, I'm quoting them a lot because they just wrote such good articles. I really like them. So thank you for connecting me with them. I'm going to look up all their other work. But Joshua Badge sort of said that there's this, like, promise of the quarter acre block, and that it's a complete scam, and that, like, the idea of owning property is so distant for so many people. And then when it does come, normally it comes with decades of debt. And, like, yeah, the idea that maybe one day I'll be the landlord,
yeah,
is just a carrot, and that when you don't follow the carrot, then you get the stick of homelessness.
Yeah, and there's a lot more sticks going around than there are carrots, really.
There are.
There's just kind of that one carrot moment that we're all kind of following
maybe
around.
Maybe I'll be the exploiter.
Yeah, amazing. It reminds me of that quote about it's about Americans, but I think it really applies a lot to a lot of the ways that Australians have, or the Australian context has kind of, like, chipped away at that sense of, like, unity and solidarity, is that idea of, like, poor people don't see themselves as being poor people, or they don't see themselves as being part of, like, an exploited working class. They see themselves as temporarily embarrassed billionaires, and, like, oh, if I work hard, and you literally, people get told constantly, like, if you work hard and you believe in yourself and you do your best, you will succeed. And it's like, bullshit. Like, no, you won't. Some of the hardest working people that I know are people who are, you know, never going to be able to retire. I'm thinking of, like, my mum's friend who's nearly in her 60s and still does, like, physical work constantly because she has to, right? Like, she's got a mortgage to pay off that she's been paying off for 30 years or whatever. And she's like one of the hardest working people I've ever met. And she's not going to become, like, you know, successful in that kind of capitalist definition. Because not because she's not working hard and believing in herself and doing all of those, like, so-called right things, but because the system set up for her to fail and she didn't
start
with money.
That's not how people get wealth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, my parents literally are homeowners because they won a car from from a bottle of fizzy drink. Like, one of those bottle cap things. Literally, right? Yeah. Like, my family owns property because of a Coca-Cola amateur promotion that, like, they won sports car.
It's literally more likely that you'll win a lottery than you'll get to become, like, a successful wealthy person by working hard. And it's such a beautifully literal illustration of that.
Yeah, and it's like landlords as well, you know, people have this idea of, like, you know, people deserving their wealth as well. And I think that landlords are such a prime example because we've seen op-eds and we've seen people in media talking about, like, oh, I'm a landlord and I won't have any income. If my tenants don't pay rent, I won't have any income. And it's like, so you're just admitting that your only job is owning other people's houses that they need to stay in order to, you know, survive and fulfill their most basic needs.
And there's all of the mask off shit and, like, Landlords Australia that people have been posting in Auspol shit of, like, people being like, look, my tenants aren't committing any crimes or breaking the lease, but I just don't like them, and how can I illegally evict them? And, like, just because they've got coronavirus, they want to self isolate at home, but I'm kicking this Asian person out for no reason. And just, like, super fucked shit. Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard not to go off on a tangent. Yeah. There's a lot. Like, there's so much content about it, and it's so frustrating constantly to see this and to see other people swallow it. People who you think might know better, because it's what we've been being fed for most of our lives.
Mm. You were talking a bit about solidarity, and I love that idea. I'm learning to play Solidarity Forever on the guitar, which I'm very bad at, but enjoying immensely. What does solidarity look like between tenants? Like, I guess I kind of have an idea of how it looks with trade unions, but what does it look like with tenants?
Yeah, absolutely. So, glad you asked that, Noon. if we take it to, quite a high degree or quite a sort of, if we take that idea to sort of like a really stark kind of representation, solidarity might look like standing on a picket line and refusing to let a landlord evict tenants who can't pay their rent.
Yeah, right.
And that's like a very confronting image for people, which is why I say that it's like a really stark representation.
Sure.
But the first step to solidarity is just recognizing that we're in the same boat as one another. We're all subject to this like capitalist system that is, that prioritizes the profits of landlords over the human rights of tenants, and the profits of bosses over the rights of workers. So it might look like knowing that you can pay rent, but deciding to withhold your rent and join a rent strike.
Totally.
You know that there are plenty of people out there who are not going to be paying rent, not because they've made a choice out of principle to do that, but because they just don't have the money. Like, they cannot pay rent because they do not have the money at all. And knowing that the consequences of that are going to be diffused amongst all of the people who are not paying. So if there's only the people who are the most vulnerable, who have no income, who have no savings, et cetera, that can't pay, who are not paying, then they're going to feel the full brunt of the retaliation to that by landlords, by real estate agents, and by governments and the state, and saying, actually, I've got a lot more resources. I've got a lot more ability to stand up against this. And I'm going to sort of like, I have a horse in this race. So I'm going to, I'm going to get in there and put my hand up and say, I'll stand with you. In order to kind of take
actually,
the brunt of that.
That sort of ties in nicely with what we were talking before about the moratorium on evictions being half a plan, but that, people often talk about using privilege, weaponizing it in ways that benefits people without that privilege. And that's, I think, exactly what you're talking about, is that people maybe who like will be able to pay back their 6 months of rent 6 months from now, if they don't pay it, then that just creates much more space for other people who won't be able to also not pay it, and for all of us to like work through it together.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, if you withhold your rent and you can, even though you're still getting paid because you have a job that you can do from home, et cetera, and you withhold your rent, then also maybe you've got some money there that you could even redistribute to people who can't feed themselves currently. That's
totally.
An idea.
Yep.
It's also about things like, so we've got a moratorium on evictions currently, which does include a ban on blacklisting tenants from in real estate agency databases from being able to find leases again in the future. I'm very sure from my dealings with real estate agents over the years and more recently that that's not going to be strictly adhered to. Even if that hadn't been enacted, the idea of solidarity as well means that if enough people withhold their rent, then in the future, applying for a lease in, 5 years down the track or so, a real estate agent checks you on the database and sees that you've got a black mark on your record, and they look at it and they go, oh, right, it's from May 2020.
It was a coronavirus thing.
It's like there's seven people applying for this property and six of them have a black mark on their record from May 2020, then we're all kind of absorbing. It means that one person that couldn't pay the rent doesn't stand out from the crop of people.
That's such a good point. Mm.
It kind of renders that system of like qualifying people's worthiness of or deservingness of housing based on sort of like their financial capacity and stuff. It renders it a lot more meaningless a lot closer to, you know, the actual meaning, the actual impact that your financial status should have on your ability to shelter.
Yeah. So you've already talked about people who are renting but can afford, like, not precarious, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And also you kind of mentioned people who are homeowners with mortgages, that they would also be involved in this strike. I was going to also ask, like, what about, I think we do actually have at least one landlord who listens to the show, so what should landlords who are listening do? And also, what about people who are homeowners but who aren't paying mortgage, like who have paid off or whatever? Do you have, ways for them to get involved in a rent strike? And I'll get you to, like, plug more, you know, links and
Absolutely.
Petitions and come to meetings and stuff a bit later. But, yeah, just in terms of, like, engaging with the actual rent strike stuff, how about those people in those other situations?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're a landlord and you're listening to this, the best thing that you could do would be to suspend rental obligations from your tenants if you're able to. If you are somebody that is, you know, a landlord and, you know, you're only just getting by mortgage-wise on what your tenants are paying you, as in you don't have excess money or anything, or maybe you're a landlord who's also lost their job right now and things.
Sure.
A lot of banks have been offering mortgage relief to landlords. So you can go to your bank, you can say, hey, I've lost my job. Can you freeze my loans for, you know, the duration of the coronavirus crisis?
Yep.
And what we've been seeing is that banks are much more willing to offer that protection
to landlords,
mortgagees,
to
landlords,
yeah.
than landlords have been to tenants.
Yeah.
And we've even seen some cases where landlords have, where landlords have definitely been able to receive mortgage relief and they haven't passed that on to tenants. So if you're a landlord, you should be applying for mortgage relief and you should be passing that on to your tenants. And you should also be guaranteeing your tenants that you won't evict them and you won't be blacklisting them or punishing them in any way for this. And if you're,
I think, that's a really good point about being proactive about telling your tenants that you're, like, thoughtful and caring about their situation right now. And, like, not blacklisting someone is kind of a passive thing. Like, maybe the nice landlords who listen to our show were not going to blacklist anyone anyway, but, like, I really agree that communicating that with your tenants and being like, hey, I'm not going to do this is a really
good way to... I'm not like the other landlords. I'm a cool landlord.
Right. But, like, being a little bit more proactive about, letting people know that they're safe and secure in their housing at the moment or whatever. Just, yeah.
Absolutely.
It can make a big difference to how people are experiencing it.
Absolutely. And if you're a homeowner who is no longer paying a mortgage, I guess maybe think about redistributing some of your wealth at this time, / in general. You could...
yep.
find an organization that is, providing food to people. There's a lot of people like migrant workers, international students, et cetera, who are not covered by JobSeeker or JobKeeper. There's refugee and asylum seeker organizations providing food to people. You could, if you know somebody who is about to be kicked out or in a really precarious position because of coronavirus, you could be like, hey, here's $1,000. I don't know.
Totally.
I don't know what's a reasonable amount because I've never really had that much money that I could give somebody $1,000 and it wouldn't ruin me. But it's nice.
Yep.
It sounds nice. And if you are, if you're basically not affected by the coronavirus crisis, I guess, like, A, thank your lucky stars, and B, probably just try and help some people that have been affected by it because I think it's so rare for people to not be adversely affected by this at the moment.
Yeah. There was another little, like, sort of practical question that maybe is a bit tricky and it's a bit unfair to ask you to answer this question, but give it a go.
Yep.
I think probably most people who are listening live in a share house of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And probably in many of those share houses, some people will be keen to do a rent strike and others won't. Do you have any, suggestions about what to do when you're not the decision maker about your rent, or like what to do when there's an issue about, like, I guess, conflict of solidarity with your housemates versus solidarity with the people in another house or whatever,
Absolutely. So I think that one of the things that I would like to say is that that's kind of one of the reasons that we see it as really important to pivot towards the formation of the Renters and Housing Union, because there are a lot of really complex circumstances and situations, and rent strikes in general historically have pretty much the track record is that they work when, like, they do work. Strike action works, but a lot of the time, rent strikes need to be meticulously organized over a period of months or years, and they need a lot of infrastructure. They need a lot of hours. They need a lot of people really dedicated to pulling it off. And we haven't had that because the coronavirus crisis hit us so quickly. And so we need to build that kind of solidarity and that, that kind of spirit of, like, collective action back up among renters and also just among people in general in Australia. And also because there have been a lot of, there's been some concessions from the government. There's the federal government that said, hey, there's a 6-month eviction moratorium, but also we're going to let the state sort out the details and also just sit down and have a chat with your landlords, like, work it out. Yeah. And so one of the roles of the Renters and Housing Union is going to be to help people advocate for themselves and also to advocate collectively on behalf of renters, because we, you know, real estate agents have been doing some real dodgy stuff, and people often don't have the best information, or they're not super, like, legally and financially literate in the ways that you kind of have to be to interpret like complex legislation and things. So being able to provide really accurate and accessible information to people peer to peer, and also to be able to help people negotiate collectively, so, you know, if you're with a certain real estate agency, figuring out who else is renting through that agency and negotiating with them. Is something that
makes
we
a lot
can
of sense.
Do.
Yeah.
And also just providing advice on how to deal with the things that real estate agents are saying, because people in share houses are often, do often have, like, very different circumstances. And I think it's very reasonable to say that because you can't get your whole house to agree, or not everyone in the house is willing to take their risk, then it therefore makes it a bit unfeasible for just one person to stop paying rent, because it means that your rent's just going to be short. And
it's sort of like everyone gets in trouble or whatever.
And so if not everyone's willing to take that risk, then it's not super feasible for one person to just go it alone. And that's okay, because it's really scary. And also, you know, we know that there could be adverse consequences. We're hoping that we're going to be able to be strong enough collectively to fight those consequences together. And we're going to organize and we're going to fight to make sure that we can do that. But I would say share houses, look, sit down and talk about it with your housemates. Look at all of the information that you have available, and see what your rights are, see what the landlord's obligations to you are, and do some negotiating as best you can. We've got some advice on how to do that negotiation, and we will be putting up on our new website, which I'll plug in a little bit, I'm sure.
I mean, we should be wrapping up now, so actually that might be,
So you can go to, let me just double check. Yes, www.rentersandhousingunion.org, and check out our new website. And that'll have information on how to negotiate, what your rights are, what sort of pathways you might have to follow. And we're also collecting a lot of evidence around the dodgy stuff that a lot of real estate agents have been doing, because a lot of it's illegal. And they're basically just banking on people believing what they say, taking it in good faith, and not pushing back against it, because they've basically been successful with that for a really long time. And people kind of tend to trust what they hear from their real estate agent and take it at face value, when a lot of the time it is misinformed, it's biased, it's sometimes illegal. And that's why we need that collective action to push back against that, because I think that those real estate agents and those landlords have been kind of just acting with impunity on that for far too long. And that's why we need, like, a peer organization that represents people face-to-face. We're self-advocating and self-representing, and we're member-run, and we're a union rather than just an advocacy group. So people can vote on how we do things and you know, what our policies and things are.
Not to throw specific shade, but is that, like, as opposed to, for example, the Renters Association of Victoria, they're not a union, they're just an advocacy body? Or, like, Tenants Victoria, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So they, I believe they actually started out as a union, and then over time they've become just an NGO, non-government organization, an advocacy group. And they do provide some really good resources. Like,
totally,
on their website,
I've got a lot of help from them before.
Yeah, they've got really good resources, and they do a lot of the work of putting things into plain language and accessible kind of formats and helping people find information. But they're not a union, which means that they're not democratic, and they're not representative of
doing
the people.
Doing solidarity and strikes and so on,
Yeah, so we're going to be a lot more kind of nimble and a lot more able to kind of take some much more sort of direct action rather than just sort of like releasing statements and saying like, please.
Yep. And if people want to help out with organizing or coming to those mandatory meetings, or if they want to help out other ways, can they like get in touch with you or come along or volunteer or anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to just make it clear that the mandatory meetings thing was a joke. It's not purely compulsory.
Yeah, definitely.
So you can check out the Rent Strike Facebook group, Rent and Mortgage Strike Facebook group will have details. And then you can also find the local groups in your area through that, which is going to be quite crucial to building that. You can go to the rentersandhousingunion.org website, and you'll be able to sign up through the website, which will then put you in touch with people who can invite you to those meetings and who can say, hey, we need X, Y, and Z things done. Would you like to volunteer and things? So definitely welcome people getting on board and helping out.
That's great. And we'll post links to all of that stuff in the show notes and on Facebook. So if listeners are keen, you can get in on that. Cool. I think that just about wraps us up. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about it. It's really exciting. And I think, as you said, it's a radical proposal and one that might be a way to build a new culture of solidarity. And I think that is the most exciting thing. Like, obviously, it's great to, like, we need to help people in precarious situations. But I think it's just such a good goal to set out to help people support with and connect with one another and stand together against the people who are fucking with us all.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. I hope that I said the things that I meant to say. I'll probably in like 5 seconds be like, oh, I meant to say like so much other
all
stuff
these
and I just waffled on.
Happens to me literally every single week. Yeah. And we didn't get any Michel Foucault jokes in, I'm sorry. But that's right.
No.
Maybe
we'll workshop that.
I was promised Foucault jokes in the lead up to this interview, listeners, but it was good anyway.
I completely forgot about that. Oh, God. Well, I mean, I guess it's just that we've got a time limit, which is like a prison.
Nice.
I'm reaching.
That's great.
I'm reaching, but, you know.
All right, Jack, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That was great, Noon. I really enjoyed that conversation. I enjoyed how kind of wide-ranging it was and how you two talked about notions of solidarity in general. And I thought that was really fascinating. So thank you very much for that.
And make sure to check out the Renters and Housing Union Victoria website. We will put a link in the show notes. When I was talking with Jack earlier this week, there were some technical issues, but we think it should be online and available by the time that this episode is up. So yeah, go check them out. And we'll post links to their like Facebook and stuff as well. And you can go help out if you want.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for tuning in, everybody. As always, you can help us out in many different ways. If you really like what we do, then please share us with your friends and family and anyone else who you think might enjoy a listen. We'd really appreciate it. If you like what we do even more and you haven't already done so, you can go and leave us a review. Best place to do that is Apple Podcasts, though I think you can also do it on Stitcher and in a couple of other places. And actually, we have a new review this week.
This might be my favorite one that we've ever gotten. I'm not sure about that. It's close, definitely.
It's our first ever 3-star review, 3 out of 5.
I think we have had one-star review, and the rest have all been five. So, you know, three is exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely new territory for us. This is from someone called Lorem... Oh, well, it's Lorem Ipsum, but they reversed the first letters of the words. Whatever. Funny joke. Huh?
Yoram Lupsum.
Yes, thank you, Noon. The review is titled Insightful But Unfunny, and the entire text of the review reads, Analysis is decent, but the jokes are stale.
And I don't know if you were trying to make a food pun there with that stale, but if you did...
Hey!
I'm going to borrow that one.
Good job. Fuck yeah. Honestly, I don't know why I find this so funny. I guess because I would have assumed that if people had an issue with this, it would have been in the opposite direction.
Yes. Yeah, like, yeah.
These two losers have no idea what the fuck they're talking about. They just love the sounds of their own voices. I love they're like, yeah, no, I mean, as far as a news show, this is pretty good. So, fuck.
Thank you, Yorm. We'll take it.
Yes, take it where we can get it, no doubt. That is also now the top review on Apple Podcasts for us. So if you do actually like us,
it would be great if you could put a different one up there.
It would be really good if you could go and put another one. You know, this is pretty funny.
we also are halfway through the Marxist meme series Noon and the Dunce, and the next one will be coming out this week. So I've been like shilling those in various groups that aren't specifically Ozpol related because it's not specifically Ozpol content. But yeah, we've been excited about doing that. And if you have feedback about that, or if you like those, you can share them as well as just our regular episodes. That would be great. If someone doesn't care about Ozpol but does care about Marxist economic theory, hook them up.
I've always said that Marxism is a gateway to Snackpod. So yes, keep your ears peeled for those Noon and the Dunce episodes, just like a hawk. Okay, eagle. Just like an eagle. Also, we have a Patreon. Go and give us money if you want to. We really appreciate it. Monthly bonus episodes, Discord, pins, all that good stuff. That probably should just about do us for this week. Thank you again for tuning in, and please, whatever you do, at all costs, make sure that you keep on snacking in the free world.
Eagle, eagle. I mean, fuck. Crunch, crunch.